Conference says the exact date for a new round of talks between Tehran and other JCPOA signatories on the removal of sanctions will be finalized soon. Israeli forces fatally shoot a Palestinian near the West Bank city of Tulkar just a day after killing another one in the occupied Al-Quds. Violence erupts in the first political rally held by a French far-right presidential candidate near the capital of Paris. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran says that the Vienna talks with the P4 plus one countries have not been halted and will be resumed later this week.
Due to the insistence of the other parties who needed to consult with their capitals on Iran's proposals, the Islamic Republic accepted to adjourn the talks. God willing, at the end of this week, the next round will begin. The exact date of the talks will be soon finalized by the EU Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Mr. Mora and the Iranian top negotiator Mr. Bagheri. What is important is that the other parties follow suit on Iran and return with clear proposals.
Well, Said Khatibzadeh said that Western governments seek to commit themselves to as little as they may when it comes to their obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. The spokesman noted that Iran, on the other hand, is determined to obtain a good agreement within the framework of the accord. The spokesman also dismissed what are called Western blame game on the talks and said that Iran's proposals are in strict compliance with the nuclear deal and agreements in the previous round of the Vienna talks. Israeli forces have shot and killed a Palestinian man at a checkpoint near the occupied West Bank city of Tulkar. The Palestinian was gunned down after he rammed a vehicle into an Israeli guard who was seriously wounded. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas, have hailed the attack against Israeli forces. They say that represents the natural reaction of the Palestinian nation against Israeli crimes. Now, the incident followed another fatal Israeli shooting on Saturday of a young Palestinian man in occupied Al-Quds. Israeli police said that he tried to stab an officer after wounding a man. The incident drew widespread condemnation from Palestinian officials, the UN and rights groups. They say that was the continuation of Israeli aggression against Palestinians and their extrajudicial killing by the regime. Well, a short while ago, we were joined by Mona Candela correspondent Ramallah, and she says that Israeli forces are quick to pull the trigger with the intent to kill Palestinians.
Palestinian officials, Palestinian factions, Hamas and other groups have condemned the killing of Palestinians in cold blood because in case any of the Palestinians would be posing any kind of threat against Israeli soldiers, they could simply fully armed Israeli soldiers, they could use their weapons to injure those Palestinians and arrest them and take them to the court. But instead of all this, Israeli soldiers at checkpoints or wherever they are in the occupied territories, they are quick to pull the trigger and they are quick to open their fire against the Palestinians because they adopt the policy shooting to kill and not shooting in order to injure and arrest later. Israeli Prime Minister Benny Gantz immediately issued a statement praising the action of the Israeli soldier at the Jabara checkpoint, and he praised them for being quick to kill a Palestinian young man there.
Now, Afghanistan is being hit by drought, economic and displacement crises deteriorating day after day. With the World Bank donors expected to meet soon, Afghan people have pinned their hope on them to take some practical steps to alleviate the financial problems of the war-torn country. We have a report from Kabul.
The World Bank spokesman has announced that donors to the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund have agreed to decide about the transfer of funds to humanitarian aid agencies by December 10th. In the meantime, people in Afghanistan complaining about the ongoing crisis in their country call on the donors to let the flow of aid and unfreeze the blocked assets.
I expect the donors to stick to their promises. What are they waiting for? We have lots of problems, including poverty and unemployment. Everyone will starve if no aid is sent to Afghanistan.
جهان میگه ما بشر دوست داریم.
The world countries have always said that they are after helping us. The situation is worsening as the winter is around the corner. We hope that the World Bank donors help us get out of this disaster by sending humanitarian aid.
Economical experts say that however the aid would be helpful, but the international community, in cooperation with the Taliban, must seek other stable approaches for Afghanistan's economy, rather than relying on temporary programs.
The Taliban should show flexibility against the international community's request to gain trust so that the aid could be handed over to the new government in Afghanistan. The transfer of the frozen assets can be very fruitful amid the current poverty that the Afghans are struggling with.
This comes as the UN bodies and aid agencies are calling for more urgent assistance as winter bites. World Food Program says that it needs $2.6 billion to ramp up life-saving support to reach 24 million people in 2022. The U.S. has frozen nearly $10 billion in assets of Afghanistan as it tries to keep the Taliban away from accessing the money. The U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have led to a wave of hunger and poverty in Afghanistan, pushing a large portion of the people to the brink of a catastrophe. Afghans now hope that donor countries agree to extend a helping hand. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Now, the first political rally by a French far-right presidential candidate has turned violent near the capital of Paris. Violence erupted after supporters of Eric Zemmour started throwing punches and chairs at an anti-racism group dressed in black with "No to Racism" on their t-shirts. The scuffles reportedly continued outside a venue where Zemmour delivered his first speech since declaring his candidacy for the April election. Meantime, hundreds of anti-racism ralliers also marched in Paris. Zemmour is facing criticism for his anti-Islam and anti-immigrant views. The 63-year-old, who has been convicted for inciting racial hatred, is the main challenger to traditional far-right figure Marine Le Pen. Some surveys suggest the two could eliminate each other by splitting the far-right vote in the first round of the presidential election, most likely against incumbent Emmanuel Macron on April 10th.
France's top NGOs and some unions rallied against the first presidential campaign stop of Eric Zemmour, a far-right journalist whose candidacy would have been unthinkable prior to the Islamophobia wave which has gripped France since the start of the great financial crisis. Zemmour is being called a Trumpian candidate for many reasons. He is not a part of any party. He has accused refugees of being thieves, killers, and rapists. He has been convicted of anti-Muslim speech and even wants to forbid giving babies Muslim names like Mohammed.
Zemmour is 100% racist. He should be kicked out of the race immediately based on the laws we have in place against racism. Zemmour profits from being a Jewish person in that he is being allowed to say things about race and religion which no one else would be allowed to say.
Zemmour thrives on outrage, but his popularity also stems from the fact that France's mainstream politicians have been totally discredited due to endless corruption scandals and kowtowing to the demands of Brussels and high finance.
The Yellow Vests oppose Zemmour and all fascists. We fight for the people and the rights which they are denied. Zemmour and Macron are the same dangerous sickness because they defend the rich class and also the same individuals. Both of them are just puppets who have the exact same puppet master.
It appears that the fight against Zemmour will serve as a safety valve because it's being presented in the mainstream media as a fight for progressive politics. However, even if Zemmour does not reach the second round, there appears to be essentially no chance that an even moderately progressive politician will take office in April.
It's essentially a three-person race between Zemmour, the far-right's Marine Le Pen, who lost in 2017, and the incumbent Emmanuel Macron. Macron is on the far right economically and has also closed scores of mosques and forced the closure of the important NGO, the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The center and left is running behind the conservatives, making France's April election extremely right-wing and seemingly more right-wing every day. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
The French president's visit to Saudi Arabia and a number of other Persian Gulf Arab countries has drawn criticism from rights groups. Emmanuel Macron is accused of rehabilitating Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He is the first Western leader to visit Riyadh since Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018.
French President Emmanuel Macron wrapped up his two-day tour of the Persian Gulf after a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Saturday. During Macron's visit to Jeddah, he and the Saudi Crown Prince discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis hit Lebanon. Beirut has been suffering from an economic crisis exacerbated by a diplomatic dispute between Lebanon and some Arab Persian Gulf states, especially Saudi Arabia, which had blocked imports. The rift between Riyadh and Beirut was sparked when former Lebanese Information Minister George Kardahi criticized the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. Macron landed in Jeddah after visiting the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. His visit marked the first meeting of a Western leader with Mohammed bin Salman since the assassination of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed that a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. U.S. intelligence services revealed that the gruesome killing of Khashoggi was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman. Macron's visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to rehabilitate bin Salman. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip, given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations, such as the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, threatening activists, imprisoning human rights defenders, slaughtering Yemeni civilians, and so forth. Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. However, in a stark contradiction to his assertion, the French president signed a multi-billion-dollar military contract on the previous day with the UAE during his visit to the country as part of his tour.
The reality is that France will put money, will put business, will put profits before human rights, before freedom, and before democracy. And the French are very keen to expand their military relationship with Saudi Arabia, partly to increase the amount of revenue they receive from their annual weaponry sales to the kingdom, but also to compete with British military sales to the kingdom.
The UAE plays a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and millions more displaced, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Now, Russia has issued a stern warning that Europe may return to the nightmare scenario of military confrontation. NATO is planning to deploy U.S. medium-range missiles near Russian borders, and Ukraine's military buildup have fueled tensions. And Russia is hoping to prevent escalation through legally binding security guarantees, the draft of which is being prepared in Moscow. Marina Kortanova has a report.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, in all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to these could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
And that brings us to the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Kettle whistling. Well, I think this is one of the relaxing sounds at home. Two teaspoons of loose tea in the teapot. Then hot water. Now I put the teapot on the kettle and let the tea be brewed up on a low burner stove. Nothing is more enjoyable than a calm home. One of the relaxing factors for a home is the architecture. Architecture is a type of art which has been of much importance since very past times. In the history of art, many buildings have been built around the world which shine like glittering gems. Today we are going to visit one of these buildings, Saroy Roshan, located in the capital city of Tehran. Saray Roshan is the name of a beautiful building in Tehran, which has attracted many visitors. The building was built in 1932. Regarding its history and architecture, this building is very valuable. Saray Roshan is one of the first commercial centers of old Tehran and is located in the middle of Nasser Khosrow Street near Marvi Ali. The architecture of Saray Roshan is inspired by Gothic architecture. This building was damaged after a period of time, but it was repaired beautifully by the well-known Iranian architect Kamran Safomanesh about three decades ago. In this building, the combination of Iranian and European elements of architecture are used. The decorations of pillars and statues of the building are inspired by Baroque architecture in Europe. Ahura Mazda design, which is the symbol of Achaemenid era, and the traditional tile works, which are the symbols of Islamic Iranian art, are used in this building. I am now at Nasser Khosrow Street. This street is one of the crowded streets of Tehran. It's not a long way to Saray Roshan, and I hope that my destination be less crowded so that you could hear my voice better. I am now next to Saray Roshan. Here is one of the earliest commercial centers of old Tehran. This place used to be a busy place, yet today is not booming as before. Nowadays, Saray Roshan consists of some shops and a big yard. There is a very big basement in this market, which is being used as a place for storing goods. Let me get a little closer to this structure in order to watch its beauties. I am now in front of the magnificent entrance of Saray Roshan. The balconies and tall pillars of this mansion are among the aesthetic elements of this building. Oh, look. On top of the wall, there are statues of angels. How beautiful! Just beneath the statues of angels, which are the symbols of European architecture, there is Ahura Mazda design. And below it, there is a big window. And in front of the window, there is a beautiful balcony. Six windows are situated next to this window symmetrically. Over and below the windows are decorated with beautiful blue Iranian tiles. Oh, this building is very beautiful. Some of the designs in Saray Roshan building include winged sun, winged bodies, column capitals with beautiful decorations and colorful, attractive designs, which I can hardly describe them. If you happen to travel to Tehran, surely visit Saroye Roshan and enjoy its beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, how long does it take for members of the so-called international community to forget about a ruler ordering the murder of a journalist, a crime which was so blatant that it took place in a consulate in a foreign country, and the murderers cut the journalist into pieces and discarded the remains? It appears 3 years is enough time for French President Emmanuel Macron to forget what happened to Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And according to the CIA, he was killed by henchmen on the direct orders of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the man Macron is in Saudi Arabia to see. What does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis in Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies, again, came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
But I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. And the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Washington. And Michael, what do you make of Macron's visit at this time?
Well, Macron, as one African journalist terms him, the cookie monster, given that his name is similar to the French cookie, Macron, has delusions of grandeur. He wants to reestablish France as a world power. And he has pressured the Lebanese government to have their information minister resign after he had dared to criticize the Saudi war in Yemen. I think that Macron wants to sell more weapons, just like the British and the French do to the region. And there's certainly far too many weapons there now. And he wants to make up, as your commentator said earlier, for the loss of the a submarine contract with Australia. I think that Macron is tied up with some rather unsavory characters like Mohammed bin Salman, who is, as your commentator said, is a essentially a repulsive and repressive despot who doesn't flinch at murder, at capturing people who are dissidents from other countries and jailing them. So I think that Macron should stay home and keep his mouth shut and help work to get the foreign soldiers out of the region like the Americans and other countries.
Well, Zafar, do you think that with his visit, Macron's basically giving a nod to his Western counterparts that the minor reprimand of not visiting Saudi Arabia via official delegations is now over?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, most Western governments do not really care about human rights. Their overriding concern is to promote their economic interests, and in particular, weapons sales to a region that is already awash with billions of dollars worth of weapons that are being used against innocent people. We know both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been involved in this brutal war against Yemen since March of 2015, where, according to the United Nations' own estimates, several hundred thousand people have been killed. Also, Saudi Arabia is involved in destabilizing Lebanon. It has sent mercenaries into Syria and Iraq. And the UAE also, which is a partner in crime with the Saudis in Yemen, these new weapons that they have purchased, which obviously would be supplied by the year 2027. But it clearly indicates that as far as Macron is concerned and other Western rulers, they don't care about human rights. They basically only are interested in promoting their own interests. And If there is a government that stands up for its own rights, which is perceived as being contrary to the interests of these Western regimes, then of course these Western regimes trot out this argument of human rights. So I'm afraid this latest deal is going to further destabilize the region. It is not going to do anything for the people of the region.
Michael, how do you see it? I mean, is that the overall goal? You heard Zafar just now talk about that he's afraid that it's going to destabilize the region even more. Is that what it's all about? I mean, with these Western governments that claim that they believe in human rights and democracy and spreading it all over, but is it basically to keep these regions, specifically this region, destabilized? We see the unbelievable amount of weapons and military equipment sold in this region for them to basically get higher profit from the region, or your assessment of it all. What is it all about to you?
Well, my assessment is, just like the gentleman from Canada said, that the outside powers in the United States and in Europe let the region stabilize so they can sell them weapons, so that they can ensure that Israel does not have any opposition of any meaningful strength and power, and that they can do as they will. They can offer deals to various government officials to do their bidding, money, visas, their students in Harvard University or someplace else in the United States or Canada or Europe. So the advantage is to keep the pot boiling, to have a reason for being in there, claiming that we need to help stabilize the region. That's why our soldiers, sailors, and Marines are there. And they don't look to the bigger picture of what is being done to Yemen, what is being done to Lebanon, what is being done to Iraq or Syria. They don't see the attacks on Iran. They whine and they complain that the Iranians are not negotiating in good faith in Vienna, even though the Americans...
Well, Michael, is it that they don't see? Sorry to interrupt you. Is it that they don't see, or is it that they just basically don't care?
They see and they don't care. They see this as a means of emphasizing their ability to posture, to say that, yes, we are all for all of this and that and the other thing, but we need to be in there and we need to have close contact with scumbags like Mohammed bin Salman or other creatures in the area, and that it's to their advantage. They look good, they sound good, and nobody questions what's really behind the rhetoric and hot air.
Okay. With Zafar, we look at, of course, Macron was... He not only went to Saudi Arabia, but also Qatar and the UAE. The UAE, he finalized a deal selling 80 fighter jets to this speck of a country, basically, if we want to say. What do you make of this? It's quite unbelievable. It's amazing that the world is not in outrage, like, why would this little country need 80 more fighter jets, and not realizing the importance, the role of this place in destabilizing it even more. I'm saying, why isn't the rest of the world just not in outrage over this?
Well, essentially, much of the world, and when we talk about the world, we are talking essentially about Western powers, it is in their interest not to worry about the destabilizing effects of the policies of their allies. And what happens to the people of the region is something that they don't care about. We also need to keep in mind that the UAE is simply not capable. They do not have the wherewithal to be able to fly these planes. In fact, I can predict right from now that they will probably need to hire foreign pilots, most probably from Pakistan or Jordan or Egypt, to fly these planes for them. And of course, the French would make tons of money by sending their technicians that would supposedly maintain these this hardware that is going to be supplied to the United Arab Emirates. Unfortunately, the United Arab Emirates is punching way above its weight. It's a tiny country, it has a tiny population, and the majority of the population in the UAE is in fact foreigners. They can't even do much of the work themselves. So what we are witnessing is a situation whereby the UAE is being encouraged by these massive weapons purchases to become even more unruly. We know that the UAE has been involved in Libya, it has been, or it was involved in Syria. It was even accused by Turkey of having its hand in the July 2016 coup. So we see that this tiny country, this speck of a country, is actually punching way above its weight, and it is likely to find some times ahead if it tries to grapple and chew too much, because it won't be able to swallow it. Of course, we also see that the UAE is going headlong with its so-called normalization with the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. And again, I can foresee that the UAE is going to lose because they're not going to be able to hoodwink the Zionists to benefit the people or the government of the United Arab Emirates.
Michael, your perspective, how much does the, as Zafar said, the Zionist regime play in all of this? On the one hand, we have these Western countries and wanting to make their own profits and keeping it destabilized. But how much is it also trying to keep the area destabilized? One, because it benefits Israel, and two, also, how much does it play into trying to control and pressure the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, I think that's entirely correct. The Israelis, the apartheid entity, are deeply involved in trying to split the Arab world, buddying up to the Gulf states, essentially lines on a map, and improving relations with the Saudis, which, of course, is in keeping with the repressive nature of Israel and its efforts to destroy its neighbors repeatedly since its illegitimate creation. The Israelis have been having a fine time selling their spyware around the world, and they've even managed to sell it, I guess, to the Ugandans so they could spy on the American embassy there. That's just been a major issue. The Israelis work and dangle carrots of money and investment and travel and trade and things like this to the Arab world to make them forget all about the Palestinians and what's been done to them, and to gain allies and to ensure a monolith opposed to Iran, which is Israel's real enemy besides the United States. As long as they can do this, they're happy, they're making money, they're acquiring information, they are gaining a hand in the operation of the governments of these various countries in the region. So it's all to their benefit that they destabilize the area and make a profit out of it.
Zafar, how complicit do you see these Western governments in Saudi and UAE crimes that have taken place? I mean, you talked about a couple of them before, whether we're talking about Syria or we're talking about Libya or we're talking about Yemen. I mean, how complicit are these entities themselves for selling these type of weapons, for supporting, even giving air support sometimes to these regimes in these different countries?
I think the Western complicity is absolutely obvious. Let us begin with reviewing the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which was announced in the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. on March 26, 2015. Now, you would think that a country that is going to wage war on another country they would make that announcement in their own capital city. Their own government would be making those decisions. And yet that decision was made from the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. So that's a clear indication that the Americans had given the green light to the Saudis and their so-called allies to proceed with that war crime to attack the people of Yemen. And of course, we know that the Americans provide logistical support to the Saudis. The British are involved, the French are involved. They are basically even selecting targets for the Saudis to bomb. But of course, the Saudis are so incompetent that they often miss those targets, and instead they have been killing civilians. They have destroyed civilian infrastructure, whether it is hospitals, schools, warehouses where grain is kept, and other facilities. So when we look at the Saudi-led war in Yemen, obviously the Western governments are fully involved and fully complicit. And this extends, of course, all across the region. When we look at Syria, the United States still has its forces in Syria illegally occupying a part of Syria when the Syrian government has not given it permission to station its forces over there. The Americans have been basically supporting Daesh terrorists, and there is ample proof of that, that it was the Americans that created this monstrous group so that it would destabilize these governments, whether it is in Syria or in Iraq. Of course, in Iraq, Daesh has been defeated thanks to the efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and in particular, General Qasem Soleimani, the martyr, who was martyred because he was so successful against these terrorist groups. And even now, the Americans have their forces in Iraq, and although an agreement was signed that these forces would be pulled out by the end of 2021, and yet the Americans are simply going to change their designation and say that, well, now they're not going to be involved in a combat mission, they're only going to be involved in training the Iraqi army, and so they will still continue to stay over there. So in terms of Western complicity, I don't think that there is any doubt. The Western governments are completely complicit in the crimes that are being committed in that region against innocent people. Figuratively, we don't have an international order in which these real war criminals can be brought to justice. And that is why the people are then left with no choice but to rise up and resist these criminal forces, just as it's happening in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, etc.
So, Michael, on the one hand, we have the what Zafar talks about is the Western complicity. On the other hand, there seems to be this strange competition between these Western countries. It's as if they are so desperate financially, economically, to see who can sell the most at any cost. I mean, the combination just creates total chaos in the region. Your take on this, what can be done?
Well, unfortunately, nothing much can be done because, for example, in the United States, the sales to these countries of various sorts of weapons is really big business. Joe Biden campaigned on the basis of, oh, we're opposed to the war in Yemen, is selling $650 million worth of missiles to the Saudi Air Force. So it's say one thing and do another. And unfortunately, the people themselves in the United States and in Europe simply go along with this. They're more concerned with the virus and who's got which variant of the virus. They are concerned with keeping their jobs or getting a better job. They're people that don't associate with others because they might get the virus and therefore don't have time to read the newspaper if there is, in fact, any news in it. I was in Missoula, Montana for a week, and the local paper, the Missoulian, is basically half sports and half local news on the front page. So there's no real interest, there's no real information coming to anyone outside of what comes from the main news media, which simply parrots the government line. Basically, it comes down to nobody knows anything, nobody wants to do anything, and nobody cares.
And Zafar, Michael talked about the American people. What about the people of the region? Do you see them more and more as separating from their dictatorial rulers, becoming more and more aware of how basically they've been used and played by their regime leaders and sold out to create basically this instability and to steal their natural resources?
Well, there are different categories. For instance, when we look at Yemen, the people of Yemen, of course, have risen up. Similarly, the people of Syria against these foreign aggressors, and to some extent in Iraq. Unfortunately, in regimes like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, people have been led on this hedonistic path. While we speak, for instance, there in Saudi Arabia, there are massive concerts going on in which the people are being moved into this culture of pop music and dance and etc. And in other words, people are being entangled in vulgarity so that the people's attention would be moved away from what the regime is doing. But I'm afraid they will not last too long. I think there are rumblings of revolt, and ultimately these regimes would be consigned to the dustbin of history, as a number of other regimes were 10 years ago. So I think it's just a matter of time before the reality catches up with these regimes and people rise up in a proper way and get rid of these corruptors that are oppressing their own people.
And the reality of time has caught up with us, too, and that brings us to the end of this program. I appreciate both of you being with me. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, also shaped all our tomorrows. This program is about the life and times, the biographical account of Imam Khomeini. May God bless him and may his soul rest in peace. The leader, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran. And, of course, we are going through the second phase of the life and times of Imam Khomeini, and this is in regard to his exile back in 1963. And with me in the studio to discuss that very phase is Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is from the Holy Seminaries of Qum, a very renowned scholar. Salam, hello, and welcome, Sayyidina. Thank you very much for giving us your valuable time today.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great. Sayyidina, we were at that point discussing about some of the great characteristics and virtues of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his and rest his soul. We were talking about the fact that he was very determined to deal with the situation here in Iran, because certainly in terms of the oppression from the Pahlavi regime. And we are now talking about, of course, Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza's father. who was installed since the 1920s, as you mentioned before. And, of course, he was trying to promote an agenda which was very similar to that of Atatürk we discussed in Turkey, where he was trying to secularize Iran and remove religion from the people. But he was doing it in such a way that there was a considerable oppression of the clergy in particular. So we moved to the 60s, and we were mentioning about the fact that since the time of Mossadegh, since in 1953, where Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani's movement in terms of nationalizing the oil industry, about trying to make it a republic or an Islamic republic, but the movement didn't last. It was the coup d'etat done by the CIA, by the Americans, established the son of Reza Khan, which was Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, as the ultimate and king of kings, we can say, of the region, not only of Iran, but of the entire Middle East. And of course, they had, through him, strengthened their relations with the Zionist regime, because we know that round about this time, of course, you know, the Arabs were having their Yom Kippur War, as they called it, with Egypt. And of course, Iran was helping the Zionist regime at that time through the Reza Shah Pahlavi. And of course, Imam Khomeini spoke out about that. I mean, he certainly was, you know, these were the things that he was highlighting to the public, that, you know, here we are supporting the very enemy of Islam in the heartland of the region. So we're now on to the second phase where, you know, the Shah has, you know, after that very powerful speech that he gave in the Fezia, the Hawza here in Qom, and, you know, the soldiers went in, and, you know, we know of the atrocities that were then committed in the Hawza Fezia, where, you know, clergy were literally thrown off the rooftops and were martyred. And, you know, the whole Hawza Fezia was ransacked by the soldiers. And, of course, as you see, within a couple of days, Imam Khomeini was sent out of Iran. So I'd like you to speak now a bit about the exile, about this very important phase of Imam Khomeini's life, especially the 14 years in Najaf, where he was participating in the Grand Hawza there, giving lectures and seminars on his own right, because we now discuss the fact that he was also a Marja'i Taqlid as well. So could you enlighten us further as to what that phase of his life was about and how important it was in shaping future events?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In fact, the events of Fezia, which were pertaining to Imam's initial removal from Qom, because he didn't right from the outset be removed from Qom and Iran. He was in fact taken out of Qom,
right,
and passed to passed from pillar to post to different prisons and things,
right,
in
Iran. Okay, so there was the prison
period
as well, right?
Indeed, the period
of
prison imprisonment and people's revolts and
sure.
people's want for him to be released and so on.
Yes,
I mean, after 19 days after the events of Ashura, which was on the 6th of June, which is known as the regular Khodad demonstrations and things which take place
right.
on the 14th of Khodad,
right.
a regular event which is renowned here. As of that particular event on the 3rd of June 1963,
right.
he was taken away after that event
right.
and imprisoned. I mean, 19 days afterwards, he was imprisoned in Khars prison.
Right.
And thereupon, he was moved to different places.
And this prison was in Tehran, was it?
It is in Tehran.
It's
and then
Tehran.
He was taken to a military base where he was kept
right.
for a while.
Right.
So this whole process of him being back in Qom and away type of thing,
right.
it took a whole of almost 5 months,
right.
from the 3rd of June till the 4th of November 64. In fact, 1 year and 5 months.
Right.
A whole 1 year had taken place over
right,
that
right.
Process of time. And you see Imam Khomeini, and there are a lot of riots and demonstrations taking place for his release. And at the final straw was August of 1964, when Shah was continuing to make pro-American gestures.
Of course,
and
of course,
strong
yes.
pro-American gestures,
yep, yep.
And particularly in autumn of 1964, when they passed the law that an American person could even kill an Iranian, but he would not be judged here in Iran; he would have to go to America.
Sure.
That Imam Khomeini made his final